So this is why I would really move away from the demonization of commodity or scale or large. Large is not necessarily bad, and small is not necessarily beautiful. Both can be both.
The market went up. Two things happen. One, sometimes the producer doesn't deliver. Let's face it. I mean, it's happening these days. So they don't get the coffee, but they still sold the future and the market went up. So they still need to pay the bank to stay protected versus nothing. So they are losing on the market, but they are not even gaining on the physical coffee to compensate. And so they are facing a situation which is huge, and this can impact people very, very badly.
So we're talking about the wrong thing here when if we debate what is direct trade. Who cares? Is it a strong supply chain? Is the farmer, the roaster, the trader, and the consumer ultimately have a win-win? That's the only thing we need to aim for. If it's one person is losing, the whole thing will fall apart eventually.
Recently, I had this conversation with Christine and Guillaume about the coffee trade from within. Christina is the Secretary General of the Swiss Coffee Traders Association, and she brings her expertise as a former specialty coffee trader. Guillaume, who works with Louis Dreyfus Company, one of the largest commodity traders globally, also runs his own specialty coffee company on the side. Both have extensive experience in both the commodity and specialty coffee industries, offering valuable insights into this fascinating and complex world. In our conversation, we explored the trade, the day-to-day work of coffee traders, some misconceptions and the opacity that goes with it, the challenges, and whether commodity traders should engage in specialty coffee or better not. We also discussed the tough realities, low margins, bankruptcies, and how the new reality of high prices is challenging the status quo. Christina and Guillaume both had plenty to say. Guillaume broke down the basics of how coffee trade works, while Christina offered a critical perspective on the specialty coffee world's darling concept, direct trade. You see that there's a lot to unpack here, so let's dive in. I'm Philipp Schalberg and this is the Kaffeemacher Podcast. Welcome. So you two, you happen to sit somewhere between Lausanne and Geneva, am I right?
Maybe yeah? Both.
Yeah. We're both in Lausanne.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Both so like, offices in Geneva, so yes.
Yes.
Both.
And I also said at another point that Switzerland is one of the most important coffee countries in the world. And also between Lausanne and Geneva, there happened to be the headquarters or trading desk of some of the biggest commodity traders and also coffee traders worldwide. And we also know that Switzerland is the second or third biggest exporter of brown coffee. So Switzerland is not a dwarf. So technically, Switzerland is a dwarf, but it's one of the largest players in coffee worldwide. How did that come?
It started somewhere, and we don't really know why and where, but probably because of the access of funds and the security of the country. And it's not only coffee, right? It started also with cotton and other commodities. Switzerland is in the heart of commodity trade, and then it develops in terms of funding. It develops in terms of skills, training. In Geneva, there's a master in soft commodity trading. And then, of course, it creates all the knowledge around the sector. And it's in the center of Europe. It's quite well connected in terms of language as well. So I think there's a various reasons. But today it stayed because of the tax as well. The tax structure of the country is, of course, helping big companies to optimize that, right? Let's be clear.
I can add to that that it's also the whole origins of commodity trading in Switzerland dates back really, I think I heard like 15th century. And that's when the merchants from like Southern and Northern Europe like coincided and met in Geneva and other Swiss market towns at the time to trade goods. So as Guillaume mentioned, cotton, metals later on kind of developed as well. But a lot of other stuff was traded here, cocoa, of course, as well. And and coffee. And it really was then the 19th century, I think I also read somewhere that like there were some very powerful family-owned trading companies, like the Volcker brothers in Winterthur, and the Nestle, of course, in Vevey and in the canton of Vaud, basically. And then these companies were attracting the other traders and importers of raw materials such as cotton, coffee, cocoa, and so on. And this kind of this whole hundreds of years of history developed Switzerland into this commodity hub and coffee hub as well. And yes, you are correct. You mentioned around 55% of globally traded coffee is handled by the Swiss coffee traders who then happen to coincide because of these historical reasons and be based in this Geneva / Lausanne, partially Winterthur and the Swiss German speaking part of the country as well.
And two very big roasters are buying actually all their needs for the world, even if they sell everything to the US, for example, they're both in Lausanne. So they came creating an office in order to be closer to the trade, to the suppliers.
Because it's proximity.
Yeah. But first, so we can define what the trade is. Proximity, correct. Yeah.
So it's about trade, but it's also about people.
Indeed. But maybe Guillaume, you mentioned, of course, taxation, but that's not the only reason. There's also like really strong financial institutions here, and the trade finance has also a very strong basis here. And that's a major reason why the traders are here. And of course, Switzerland being known for innovation and great universities and talent being had, all of this is kind of add on, but the geopolitical stability, the trade finance being concentrated here, and then, of course, maybe taxation or other measures that make it easier for companies to bid here all contribute to that. But it's like it's not one single thing, I think.
So the green coffee industry is really important for Switzerland. Do you know how important it is?
Yes, we do know numbers, but currently we don't have these beautiful CTA-created report to give you, but this is kind of part of the ambition later to create these reliable data sources. But we do have, of course, the data, and the Swiss government is holding this data about export earnings. Mm-hmm. But just focusing on coffee, I've got these figures that the domestic consumption in and of itself brings a turnover around 4.5 billion Swiss francs to the Swiss economy. Add on to that, there's also coffee machinery industry, which brings 2.2 billion Swiss francs. And then what we also tend to highlight is that the coffee trade, the export value of the coffee trade is 3.5 billion Swiss francs. So the total value of the coffee market is Switzerland. The coffee is worth about 10.2 billion Swiss francs to the Swiss economy, which is around 1.25% of the local GDP of all of the countries. So incredibly important, but because it doesn't have the marketing value of coffee, doesn't have the marketing value as the same as cocoa and chocolate for Switzerland, people don't tend to know these figures because Switzerland is known for Swiss watch, cheese and chocolate. But coffee is in the background because the traders are moving this in the background, really.
Yeah, regarding the export, I think it's key to understand. I think it's related to what we said before, why Switzerland, why Nespresso has all the three factories to create all their capsules in Canton Vaud, in Switzerland. Well, it's because of knowledge, technology, skills, etc. But that's also contributing, that's contributing enormously to the export value of the coffee, right? Because even if Nescafe or Delica, other companies are exporting roasted coffee out of Switzerland, the main contributor to that is Nespresso, because they're shipping their capsules all around the globe in volume and in value tremendously, because the value is much more than just the roasted beans.
So Switzerland is really important in coffee. So next time, go to a coffee country. I said, well, I'm from a coffee country too. You may not know yet, but I'm going
not
to...
Not really a producing one still.
Yes, not a really producing one. One thing that really struck me now was that you, really early on, Guillaume, you said, yes, that some roasters came to Switzerland because they knew about the value of proximity. So being in a close-knit network with others, and because trade is happening here. So what exactly trade is, we're going to talk about right after that. But Let's talk about these networks, because there must be a network. Yeah. Christina, you are with the SCTA. You told me there's only one association of coffee traders worldwide. And of course, its name is Swiss Coffee Traders Association. What does the SCTA do?
Excellent question. Yes, this is kind of, SCTA has a very unique position, and maybe it is only possible, I would say largely, to have a coffee trade related or coffee trade focused association in Switzerland for these very reasons that we just mentioned. All the people who contributed in to developing this association many years ago, which we'll come back to, clearly were conscious of it, that, look, we have a unique opportunity here. Why don't we capitalize on this? And really the vision at the time, which Guillaume can also comment on more about how what was discussed back in the days, but where we developed right now is really we want to be focused on the perspective on the trade. The perspective on the trade is really supply chain perspective. So everything that affects this chain between the producers and the consumers, or let's say the exporters and the roasters, the traders are covering. And this is a very complex supply chain, contrary to maybe how the specialty coffee sector likes to simplify it to this so-called direct trade model. And we can talk more about in what circumstances that is an appropriate description, and in what other, maybe in the majority of circumstances, it's potentially an oversimplification of an otherwise very complex task of bringing coffee from faraway countries to Switzerland. So the SCTA really is wanting to, and within SCTA, we want to represent the green coffee traders, but through that, we really represent the whole supply chain and also the producers. So the traders are really that bridge between consumption and production. And as you will hear also, I think we discussed it in previous conversations as well, the traders have a lot of resources based in origin too. So just because the headquarters are based here doesn't mean that much. The majority of the people working for the traders are mostly employed often in origin countries. This is what people call legs, kind of boots on the ground, basically. And this is a really important part of trading, to be connected to the source and connected to the producers.
Guillaume, could you please give us a brief overview of how the coffee trade works? Because it's crucial that we are aligned on this, as I often hear that the trade process is somewhat opaque. This might be because most people are unfamiliar with the world of traders, or because the trade itself lacks transparency. Could you clarify this for us?
If I may take a step back, I think it's important that, as you just described, Christina, to define what exactly is the trade or the coffee trade that we're going to talk about today, is really, as you said, Christina, it's a company that is buying coffee, usually from origin, in different form from various people, and then selling to the brand. And why is usually coffee trade or trading houses not known or seen as opaque? It's simply because they don't own any brand. They are selling to the roaster, and they are not putting anything on the shelves and are not known by the final consumer. But they have a key role to play, and this role is quite simple to explain and understand. It's because when the crop comes in producing countries, such as Nicaragua or Honduras or anywhere, the farmers, they have to sell their crop. In most countries, they have to sell it. They have constraints in terms of cash, space, drying capacity, etc. And they have to sell the crop at a certain time. So the trade is really here to buy the coffee whenever the sellers wants to sell it. And the roasters on the other side of the chain, they want to buy whatever they want, quality, origin, type of coffee, etc., whenever they want, under the terms they want. So in both sides, the trade is actually providing a service. And that's why sometimes I don't understand why the trade is seen as some bad guys, because effectively they're just a merchant providing a service, which is to provide to offer the suppliers to buy from them the product whenever they are ready to sell it. And again, there's no monopoly. I mean, the sellers, They can decide when to sell. They can decide which quality to sell. And they have various customers making the market price. So there's no pressure on them neither to sell to a specific trader. And then the roaster, usually they demand a specific quality to be homogeneous in the container, delivered at a certain point of time. So the merchant, which is the trade house, as we call them, is usually known as a risk manager, a risk taker. They take the risk to buy the quality the supplier wants to sell at the price, at the time the supplier wants to sell, in the origin they want to sell, and then address the customer and doing the same thing the other way around. Now, in the past, it was probably very different than today, because there were a lot of barriers, right? People couldn't travel so easily. There was the time zone, the cost of communication, the language. And nowadays, it's very different for the last 20 years already, of course, but with people can connect in English from consuming country to producing countries every day for free. With Skype, with WhatsApp, they can call each other, even show the farm on their phone. So the trade has had to invent themselves. And that's when the term supply chain comes in. Because again, the roaster can sometimes know from whom they buy. They can know the farmer, they can know the cooperatives or the exporter, but they never buy from them directly. Or very rarely, and we can talk about the top of the iceberg, which is the specialty coffee world, in which you can easily trace a specific coffee from the farmer to the cup. In most cases, 98%, I don't know, the trader has a very important role to manage expectations from both sides.
Now, trade often appears very different from the outside compared to the inside, and vice versa. You're absolutely right, Guillaume. Trade itself doesn't have a brand, and by definition, it operates behind brands, placing it in a more background position. That said, I often hear that there are many aspects of trade that only insiders truly understand. And this becomes particularly evident when it comes to social events. For instance, Christina, one of the world's largest gatherings recently took place in Switzerland, the Swiss Coffee Traders Association's event in Basel. It was an in-person event, and in my latest podcast with Peter Lesch, he mentioned that if someone really wants to understand trade from the inside, one needs to be present at events like this. Why does trade require physical events today?
The coffee trade doesn't need a dinner to keep flowing, of course. But if we, I think we all, or hopefully all the listeners can relate to this metaphor that we tend to use within coffee, is that coffee is really a business of relationships. And I think anyone in coffee, no matter which part of the coffee trade or the coffee sector you identify with, you still hopefully are here because you don't just want to trade or sell or buy a stuff. Coffee is uniquely positioned, and this is what makes it really exceptional, I think, and unlike any other commodity, that through the development of coffee houses and this whole culture of coffee drinking, I mean, even historically, but to the very day today, coffee brings people together, both in the coffee shops, but also within the trade and the whole sector. So what SCTA does with this event and other associations also do coffee events. And of course, the Specialty Coffee Association does their annual event. They bring people together. Now, the question is, of course, can come, if you have the question, why the trade, why we only have 1,000 people, for example, because we had over 1,000 people coming to the two-day event. But SCA events have over 15,000 people, you know, like where is the limit or what would be? So we can talk about that as well, if that is of interest, that does have some conscious choice behind. But at the same time, maybe tapping one step back as well, just to the previous conversation about the role of the trade. Firstly, maybe just looking at commodity trade, like commodity is not just coffee, any commodity trade key function is really to guarantee and the access to essential goods in society. Coffee is not the only commodity that gets traded, of course. And most of the time, we don't stop as consumers thinking about the supply chain of tomatoes or baked beans or onions or every single thing that you buy in a supermarket. attention goes to very few in terms of what goes on behind. But there is a supply chain behind every single stuff that we buy. And coffee is almost, I would say, in the fortunate position that there's a lot of attention on this. And in time, we will clarify all of these questions because it's not intentionally opaque at all. It is by design. People throughout history have not paid enough attention of how the stuff gets onto their plate, or as we move as society further and further from the self-reliance and growing tomatoes on our own in back garden and having to go to supermarket, we got detached a bit. So I think it's more of a opportunity to clarify this cultural lack of interest over hundreds of years, and now we have an opportunity to look into it and say, okay, but how does this get on into my cup, for example?
Okay, you once told me that there is a very distorted view on trade. Was this just the thing that you mentioned, like that we kind of detach ourselves from supply chains because we take it for granted that I can find strawberries in January in the supermarket?
I would say yes, it does have that relationship to the detachment of we just as consumers expect things to be available to us all year round. And you as a coffee professional know, of course, that even within coffee, there is seasonality. So you can't just access any origin at any part of the year unless there's someone behind thinking about it, making it available to you, making sure that that seasonal coffee gets imported, packaged, roasted at the right time and kept its freshness being kept as much as possible, which is, we also know, is sensitive. So yeah, I think it's a situational kind of heritage we have within coffee, but also an opportunity to clarify things and not make it opaque, but just ask questions and be curious about how this works.
People believe that all the stuff, as you said, Christina, and all the food, it should be simple and accessible and not linked to any, financial or speculative environment. And that's why we need to realize that the supply chain we mentioned has some complexities. It's not that easy to understand. It involves pricing mechanism. It involves costs optimization, etc., which is, mathematical, financial, and quite complex. So it deserves attention in order to fully understand what does the merchant do, right? So why the market, for example, why there's a futures market for coffee? Because people can say, then people speculate in the market. We should talk about the beans. We should talk about the oranges. We should talk about the strawberries. But actually, the function of the market is very important in order for the merchant to take this risk to buy whenever the coffee is available and to sell it whenever the roasters wants to take delivery of. They need to have a mechanism that's protecting themselves versus a huge market decrease, for example. And there's usually a misconcern that, for example, the merchant, they want to buy very cheap from the farmers and then they want to sell very expensive to the roaster. Well, I tried to explain to some friends that actually we would prefer the contrary. We would prefer to buy very expensive from the farmer and sell very cheap to the roaster. And that's thanks to the market mechanism. And if I explain it in a few words, if we buy very expensive from a farmer, from a cooperative in Nicaragua, and then when we buy, we sell the market, protect ourselves, right? So we buy the physical, we sell the market. If the market drops and then I deliver to a roaster, then we're going to sell it very cheap because the market dropped, meaning the price of the coffee commodity dropped. So then what's going to happen is that I'm going to sell very cheap to the roaster and at that time buy the market back. So everything that I lost on the physical beans, I made it back with the market, which has three great advantages. One, the supplier is very happy. They're going to deliver the right quality at the right time, and they're going to be willing to do business with us again in the future. On the other side, the roaster is going to be very happy. He's going to receive the right quality at the right time. He's going to pay me on time, so less risk for me. And then he's probably going to be happy to do it again next year. And then in the middle, even nicer, my own company is very happy because we sold the market very high and we bought it back very low. So we made money in our bank account. So we lost money on physical flow and we made money on the market. So everything is great. It's win-win-win. If it's the other way around, it's actually a disaster because then we buy very cheap. The supply is not happy. Maybe not shipping on time, not shipping the right quality. On the other way around, the roaster is not very happy. He bought very expensive. He might not take the coffee on time. He might complain about the quality, even if there's no reason. And in the middle, my company is not very happy at all because you need to pay what we call the margin call. And the margin call is basically if you sold something in the market and the price go up, then you need to compensate every day the price difference. So I go now into the physical or the financial side of it because it's very key to understand the mechanism as well. It's called hedging. And when you do hedging, you actually protect yourself versus an adverse price movement. And there's a very wrong connotation of hedging because of hedge funds. A hedge fund is actually purely speculative. It's money that people put in their bank account and then they invest to make money. So they buy, they want it to go up, they sell, they want it to go down. That's wrongly misleading because when we are hedging commodity, we are just offsetting what we buy physically. We sell it in the market to hedge ourselves, which is protect ourselves.
When we look back to 2023 and beyond, let's say the past couple of months and then the past weeks, Christine, as you said, it was a turbulent year or an intense year. Now there are really high prices. So what does it mean for the trade, given what you just said, Guillaume? What does it mean for you as Louis Dreyfus?
So it creates a situation which is quite complex to navigate because of two things. One, the price of commodity is very high. So again, the farmer or the exporter, the origin people are very happy. The cost of production is much, much lower than the current prices they get for the goods. So that's working well. But then the cost of money became more expensive. And so if last year I was, you know, buying, let's say, 100 tons and selling 100 tons, I needed certain capital to do so. Well, today, imagine the price doubled, then well, I can do only 50 tons with the same amount of money. And the banks, when there's more risk, they're not really willing to increase the limit. So what I mean by that is that the cost of the commodity is creating difficulties for people to handle it properly. And then, of course, the margin call. As we said, if I own coffee, physical coffee, then it means I sold the futures, the market. And if the market goes up, as it did, well, we need to put money on the table to continue being protected. And that's creating a very complex situation. And we are seeing exporters in various origin countries, you know, declaring bankruptcy is a bit too tough for now. But yes, having big problems because they bought the coffee, they sold the futures, so they sold the market. The market went up. Two things happened. One, sometimes the producer doesn't deliver. Let's face it. I mean, it's happening these days. So they don't get the coffee, but they still sold the future and the market went up. So they still need to pay the bank to stay protected versus nothing. So they are losing on the market, but they are not even gaining on the physical coffee to compensate. And so they are facing a situation which is huge and this can impact people very, very badly. And that's when people need to buy back what they sold at the market, and that's creating a big loss. So that's the problem right now, is that the market is high for a reason. You know, the market is high for a reason. There's a smaller crop in Honduras. There's a smaller crop in Brazil. There's consuming countries like China, how increasing their consumption. Or there's basically not enough coffee in the world, so the price needs to go up to incentivize producers, farmers, to produce more or to find new lands to produce coffee, etc. So that there's, again, an oversupply, which is going to push the market back down. But it takes time. It takes not so much time to abandon the farm, You know, when the price is too low, the farmers are abandoning the farms to produce maybe pepper, avocado, or other fruits in Guatemala. It takes 1 year to abandon a farm, but to create a farm, to produce a new farm, it takes a few years.
Yeah. So you mentioned it. You said it's not a so-called bankruptcy yet, but if I look back to the past month, there are some trading houses that disappeared or got merged into something else or got bought from someone else. Looking at the situation right now, will some trading houses disappear?
Yes, probably. Probably, yeah. Because of the constraints, the cost of, you know, a trade house is mostly people, right? They sometimes they own factories at the origin, they are exporters, yes. But some trade houses, it's only the people. And the cost of the people is something that is you know, stable or increasing. So the current situation is creating a lot of tension, and they might suffer some losses due to, you know, margin call defaults from either side. So, yes, we can say that some companies might disappear, as we've heard here.
Cristina, you leading the Swiss Coffee Traders Association, a network of trading houses that all have the same, let's say, challenges these days. What is your role in this moment, and what are you hearing, and what is something an organization like yours can do?
I would just add, they're facing very much same or similar challenges, but not exactly the same. I mean, there are differences between traders and traders in terms of size as well. We in Switzerland, we also have small traders who are only based in Switzerland. They don't have a legal entity in Europe or anywhere else. But then we also have the larger trade houses that most people would have heard of, maybe, who have other options, maybe, and other legs to stand on if things get difficult. So I would say the only Swiss ones face maybe yet another level added challenge in that sense. But I think what as Guillaume summarized it as well, it's difficult for everyone. And what I try and also we are trying to be a voice for the green coffee traders. And there's voice to be that, hey, the traders are here to maintain a balance in the supply chain as well, and maintain the delivery of coffee to the roasters, to the consumers ultimately, and to also create business for the producers. But the trade itself and the green coffee traders operate on very narrow margins. So there's a lot of risk taking. Traders will most of the time, merchants or traders, it doesn't matter like what words you use, but they are really risk managers beyond everything else that we discussed here, of course. Stabilizing prices, guaranteeing supplies, building and maintaining relationships, mastering logistics, not to forget, they also get coffee from A to B across the ocean, with the help of many other people, of course, and supply chain actors, but mainly it's risk management. Yes, that in and of itself should have a reward. I mean, they are doing a service, but at the same time, the margin is much, much lower than people would envisage, especially when it comes to the commodity or the trading at scale side. I think we started talking about the complexity of the supply chain, and maybe I'm almost hearing some specialty roasters questions very valid points, who are saying, hey, yeah, but we are doing direct trade. We are buying from Jorge in Honduras, and this is not that complicated. What are you talking about? And that's right. Anyone can trade coffee. You know, good luck. You can do that, actually, of course. The question is also at what scale, at what speed, at what cost, and at what reliability. Because you can, so this is where we would go into maybe a commodity versus specialty world. And I know you wanted us to talk about that as well. But it's really important to say, yes, of course, you can simplify it. We don't say complex for the sake of creating this mysterious, nebulous mist of trade. Mm-hmm. But there is complicity in it. Anyone who have tried their hands at importing coffee from anywhere else, because it doesn't grow in Europe, of course, it's not a one-man job. Yes, you can meet the farmer, agree with him that you buy X number of bags if you are large enough and you are lucky and large enough and skillful enough to fill a container with that coffee or with even multiple farmers coffee, and you only you have coffee in that container, you're already really significant in terms of the specialty market. But it's that's the first hurdle. How do you fill a container of 120, 60 kg bags to start off with? And you have to finance it. You have to pay for it, pay the farmer, pay the logistics of it. Then you will sell it. So there's a few things behind it. And of course, all the documentation, which again, not rocket science, but can be a bit scary at the beginning because there's all sorts of certificate of origin, the invoice, the contract, the phytosanitary certificates and other things that it has to trade is regulated. And you have to comply with all of that. So yes, everything's possible, but you also have to pay the farmer and just transfer money into someone's bank account in countries outside of Europe. And even if you have insurance on it, if something goes wrong, then it can become a huge issue very quickly. And those countries' legal system will not stand on their head to support you in getting your money back if the farmer didn't honor their contract. And this is why relationships and trust become so important and almost impossible to overestimate it, because you want to deal with people who deliver the stuff that you agreed on at the quality and at the time that you agreed on. Don't just walk away. And if you're just starting out from nothing, it's not a very good idea just to go on a coffee trip in Honduras and just shake hands and hope for the best. You are going on recommendations, hopefully, even if you want to start your special business fund. You can do that, but look into like really what are the existing trusted relationship supply chains so that you, if something goes wrong, then you have a plan B, because this is that biggest risk in there.
What's the difference between serving a roaster like you, like a specialty coffee roaster, versus other roasters? And I thought about it briefly. And if you want to attend, you can classify, let's say, four different type of roasters. You've got the specialty one, then you've got, and the specialty one to start with, well, they focus on what? First, quality. Then probably, and you correct me if I'm wrong, then story, something rare, something new, maybe the processes, a sense of discovery, and then an economical transparency, right? You want to know what kind of money is going to the farmer, etc. And then at the end of these criteria become, you know, the availability, the timing, or the price. But if you move to somebody buying premium and traceable coffee, as many roasters are, well, what they want first is, you know, a quality consistency. They want sourcing traceability. They want to know where it goes, where it comes from, but not in so much details as the specialty coffee roasters. They want long-term partnership. So over the crops, they can buy from the same region, from the same guys. And then they look at the logistics, the timing, and the price. But then if you move to the mainstream buyers, well, they just want a blend and a basket. They don't care if you give them Peru or Honduras. And then they want the price. And then they want the logistics to work so that they can roast and deliver the coffee at a cheap price. And the fourth category, if I may just split and simplify into four, is the instant coffee business, which is big, you know, instant freeze-dried, spray-dried coffee. Well, they're first going to look at the price. Price is criteria number one, which is criteria number eight for the specialty coffee roaster. And then they look at the yields. They look at the availability, the logistics, and the timing. I try to change the order, but that's really the price first. And so when you're a seller, when you're somebody attending as a marketer, you're attending the customer, well, it's four different, very different customers that they're focusing on different things. And that's why you can't, it's very difficult to imagine myself talking to four roasters, and the four out of these four types, my role would be quite difficult to put different hats on, and my focus will have to change all the time. My specification, my professional specification will be too wide. So either I'm focusing on the specialty and I'm a specialty guy and I travel with them at origin, I sell 80 bags, or the other way around, I can be focusing on soluble and I'm focusing differently. So it's different jobs, actually, different roles.
Different roles, yes. And so there are different models for different markets and different models for different coffee roasteries. So some, also some buyers or some smaller traders, they're really successful in direct trade. And they build their model and their system around it, and it can work out. And as we have seen this from start like 15 years ago, some bigger US roasters, that the whole philosophy was based on another model, and it's working. But some, it's roasters, they buy from a direct trader and then using the name and use its value. I'm not quite sure what the value exactly is, so I'm still about to find some people for my podcast that would like to talk about direct trades or what the real value is in terms of marketing. So I see there are different models, and they can work out for different people. One thing Christina, you mentioned it, so that the margin is really, really low. Why is it that low, and how low is it for traders?
It's, I would say, in largely, and this is a massive generalization, I would also put a disclaimer that I think a lot of misunderstandings, and this, even when we talked about the opaqueness of the trade, mm-hmm. comes from the fact that we generalize and just say the trader, the right. producer, the specialty or the commodity roasters. Like all of these are like, they're going to distort any answer I give, but I can put it into perspective that, let's say, a super high quality specialty trader, so to say, will operate or want to have around 20% margin, because the costs that they incur as well, because that quality comes at an incredible cost of people at origin selecting the right quality beans and making sure the quality is there. So that's immense cost that goes into that. But also at every step of the way, as Guillaume alluded to, the level of attention, the number of emails, the number of questions you have to respond to when it comes to the specialty, that's a lot. And that someone's got to do it. It's not ChatGPT who answers those emails, right? If a person thinks about it, sends the information, gets the story, gets the picture, the videos, the farmer interviews, and so on. So I would say that's around between anywhere around 20-30% would be ideal. I mean, even they don't get it all the time.
Yeah, I never heard above 20 so far. Yeah,
but that would be a nice, yeah. right? Because the costs can amount to that. I think operationally, maybe between 10 and 20 would be a healthy for a specialty trader as such. But then on the commodity side, it's more below 5%, and it can be anything in that, right, depending on your scale as a trader, whether you're multinational or just a local and serving a specific market. It can be anything, but definitely in the lower single digits. 1-2 yeah. percent often gets mentioned as well.
Exactly. Today, if we can do business for 1.5-2% back-to-back margin, it's probably where we stand. Because the market's high, it means that the absolute value is okay to cover our costs. But still, I would say if it's 2%, it's quite good of the value of the goods. And there's a lot of cost involved. You need to finance it. You take some risk. You need people to manage the whole supply chain, transport it, etc. So, it's quite small. But the volume is big, so usually
yes. it's okay. But should actually a big trader do specialty coffee? So should a big trader behave like a small one? Many bigger trading houses, so they create a smaller branch of a specialty trading desk, or they try to, in some cases, try to mimic a smaller one. But my experiences, personal, they were quite different. In some cases, it really worked out. So when I talk to a bigger roaster with a smaller specialty unit, it really worked out. In some cases, it just didn't feel the same. So is it really different? And talking to you, Christina, because you also have a background in specialty trade, are these two different worlds, or are they just not so separate as I just said?
Great question. And I kind of wanted to comment on this direct trade mm-hmm. conversation as well, that relates to this question of yours as well. And would rephrase the question as, is it very different for a producer to produce specialty grade coffee as opposed to commodity? And therein lies your answer. Yes and no. Depends. And it's an annoying answer. That depends. Mm. Depends on the circumstances. I would say, certainly in my professional experience, I had a fortune nut position to work for before a roastery that is relatively large in its own market, maybe not globally, but still it's not a small roaster, and yet behaves like a specialty and puts a lot of emphasis and energy into personal relationships, long-term relationships, contracts, acts like a specialty. And I know how much energy, time, manpower that demands. That roaster has more buyers than the largest coffee roaster we know. And so you need manpower behind that. Yes, it's possible to blur the lines and operate like a specialty, even if you play at scale. And you can make efficiencies. And I think there are not just them, there are other companies who are trying to do that. Or even if you look at some of the biggest roasters, they also, within Europe, they also are trying to also create their own specialty angle within or product offering, and they often have dedicated resource within their team only focusing on those two supply chains, because yes, the type of business or the way you buy and sell coffee, both at the roaster and the trader side and the producer side, dare I add as well, will be slightly different. But I would add one additional perspective on this from a producer perspective, that I don't know how many specialty roasters or professionals in any part of the specialty sector consider. You might do, because you also have your own farm and you understand more of the how coffee is produced. But I would say, if we think about how much coffee is produced in the world and all the millions of coffee farmers, which we never know how much many they are, but you know, estimations between 12.5 and 25 million, somewhere thereabouts, right? How many of them produce only specialty grade coffee? Like, that's often one of the challenges in, like, improving quality at the farm level is difficult enough, but not impossible. If you have the know-how and a lot of great people, a lot of great companies and traders are investing in educating the farmers, helping them with inputs as well. There's a whole science and art behind producing consistently high quality, and the consistency is also underlined here. Producing an anaerobic fermentation, super duper interesting flavor profile coffee 1 year, you can stumble upon it. You can have the right sort of yeast in the air and kind of ferment the coffee beautifully, but how do you replicate it year after year? You have to have some science behind as well, and understanding of what controls flavor, right? If you take into consideration all the climatic changes as well, it's becoming harder and harder to produce that consistency in quality and quantity of that quality year after year at the production end. So let's say you're a producer and you end up, it's more like a pyramid. You end up maybe with X percentage of your farm, impossible to quantify what, but depends per farm, a really high quality specialty coffee that you can sell to the specialty roaster. And if you're lucky enough, you're looped into those chains and sell it and get a great price for it. That I would say very rarely sustains the whole farm. And those same producers who provide the best quality coffee in the highest specialty coffee shops around Europe will also probably be supplying the local exporters that maybe that goes into a blend that you then would buy in the supermarket. You will never know that it's the same farmer, but they will tell you that they have different quality grades. So this is why I would really move away from the demonization of commodity or scale or large. Large is not necessarily bad, and small is not necessarily beautiful. Both can be both. We just have to see the value of all of it. And really, it's more like a pyramid that we can, yes, flatten the pyramid and make sure that there's more and more of the good quality stuff on top, or like maybe narrow it in that sense. But still, there is a space. There definitely is a space for both. I don't know if you answered your question. Maybe I went in a different direction, but...
Well, you were, but it was good. It was good. But I can ask you another question, also include Guillaume here, because from all what you said, I mean, you said, well, these markets, they intersect, they are not so different, but in the way we talk about it, they are pretty different, which means as well, if someone is And I use the term again, in the commodity market, and some use, some build their own trading vehicles and build smaller specialty business units. Why doesn't everyone do it?
We had an operation in the US, but it's again a very different focus. And indeed, the margins are there, at least per unit, but you sell little units. So overall, it's not tremendous. But I think all the big trading company moved a bit and evolved in order to provide, specialty coffee or higher quality coffee, but also other services. Right now, a trade house needs to reinvent itself. It needs to focus on quality, but also on trustability, certification, maybe carbon decarbonization projects, or et cetera, et cetera. But to respond to your question, I think it evolved, but it's also a trend, a fashion that evolved as well, the specialty coffee. I don't think it's so financially viable, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm not sure. If I go to my manager and I say we should create this hub, hire these people, the problem is that you need the connection. And we go back to the relationship, we go back to the trust, because if you don't have any customer, you're going to buy 100 bags, you're going to sell 30 bags to a great specialty coffee roasters in Scandinavia, and you're going to make your margin. Then you're going to take the risk on the rest, and you're going to sell maybe 30 bags to somebody else, but you need to reduce the price to make it work, etc. But then if you keep this coffee for longer than 6 to 8 months, then nobody's going to buy it from you at a specialty coffee price. They're going to buy it as a the risk on the quality is huge. So you need to, and if we go back to my introduction, which is a specialty coffee trader in this case needs to buy when it's available. You know, the crop in Costa Rica is going to be ready in March. The huge, great, amazing coffee that you believe is going to be the best seller of the year is going to be available in May or April shipment. You buy 200 bags, you sell 30, you make great margin, it's great, but you might just lose everything on the rest. It's a huge risk. And so we go back to, if we are interested to go back into the specialty coffee world, it would be to have a team that knows, that have a big portfolio of roasters and know them. For me, it's not the great investment. It's a lot of work.
Yes, it's a lot of work. And also, Christina, you said as well, well, the work is even more for one bag than for one container. And there are different players that work here as well. I mean, if we look at institutional buyers, so they work along the same principles, I would say. If we look at smaller players, as we are too, we may have different ideas or, let's say, less experience in the way institutional buyers buy coffee. So that can also prompt some work for established trading houses.
Yes, exactly. And it's not necessary. I'm not also not saying that doing more work is not worth it. Sometimes it's also the most rewarding type of business that you can do if you really have those conversations and you also, as a trader, learn the story, or you're already supposed to know the story of the farmer, but you learn the story of the roaster and communicate it back and forth. It's a fantastically rewarding experience for everyone. But the question is really the business model. There is a business model behind, and I think Guillaume summarized it perfectly. It's some of the smallest roasters, I would say, probably expect to find like this, you know, the coffee offer list and a variety of beautiful coffees all year round. Yes, they can change, but as long as I have a choice, like going to the supermarket and I want one bag of this, half a bag of that. And by the way, do you sell nitro packed and smaller packaging, all of that, backpack? The demand, that the list of demands is endless, which is good. That is also pushing excellence and diversification. It's all wonderful things. But if you look at it in a holistically and kind of from a bird's eye view, neither diminishes the need for the other. And it's just, maybe we are just trying to explain why yes, there is a blurring, can be a blurring in between specialty and commodity, and some people are trying, and it's a very difficult position to be in, to be able to sell large container loads as well as one bag or less at a time. Possible, but it also depends on what is there a demand for. The traders, they're serving a need. And if the need's changing, the service will shift as well. And it, we are witnessing, this is not a static thing. Neither the commodity trade nor the specialty industry have stopped evolving, I hope. I think both are evolving. They are in conversation with each other. We are doing this right now. We talked about SCTA, but the associations are also trying to contribute to this evolution. It's all an evolution. I hope it will never stop. The focus on greater transparency, traceability, now regulations are stepping into that, demanding what was maybe formerly a voluntary thing. All of this is shifting, changing, and we can have educated guesses about which way this is going. And we can go into that part of the conversation if you like as well, but the main message I'm also trying to maybe make here about when we talked about direct trade is there should be less of a focus about the directness and more focus and value given to the strong supply chains. No one wants a direct that only exists for 1 year. The producer won't want that either. You can have that if you want, but that's not the point. It's the aim is to have strong, reliable supply chain that are transparent and sustainable and sustaining thriving, coffee production and trade. And everyone benefits from the chain. That's the aim, not the drag. So we're talking about the wrong thing here when if we debate what is direct trade. Who cares? Is it a strong supply chain? Is the farmer, the roaster, the trader, and the consumer ultimately have a win-win? That's the only thing we need to aim for. If it's one person is losing, the whole thing will fall apart eventually. So that's what we are all trying to work towards, that by sustainability, we don't mean the birds and the bees, but it's sustaining an industry where everyone wins eventually. And yes, I do believe it's possible.
Maybe just to complete on what we just said, I think that the current market very high. I mean, we sell specialty coffee to Japan, for example, very high quality.
And specialty coffee is quality coffee for you now. What type of specialty coffee?
It's specialty quality, only quality.
Quality, okay.
And the price is huge. But the problem now is that as the market and the commodity itself increased so much, I just wonder what's going to happen with the specialty coffee market. Because if the specialty coffee market doesn't pay the premium we just detailed, it deserves because of the time, because of the information required, etc. Then I wondered what's going to happen, because I can give you an example. The farmers today, or the cooperatives today, they see swings in the markets that are so big that they are tempted sometimes to take advantage of a higher market to just sell all their coffee. Even if it's, a standard quality, high quality, or RA certified, organic, etc., they are tempted today, and it happened recently, they are tempted to go to the best buyer on that day. The market increased significantly. We saw on Friday, the market went up nearly 6%. You know what it means? It's huge. And so they might be tempted to just sell everything at this huge price and deliver and stop trying to get, I want an Rainforest Alliance premium of 5. 5 is a third of the increase of Friday. So they're not going to fight for that. Then the organic premium, okay, it's best if I can get it. But the market now is more important than the small premiums they got. So I just wonder what's going to happen, because the specialty coffee world will still have to pay a premium over a price, which is nowadays huge. I can give you an example. We were selling to, there's a roaster, a very known roaster, who's got a specialty coffee arm. And this roaster always told me, I buy only coffee at 300 cents a pound, which is $3, right? $3 per pound. I buy only that. Today, it's the market is higher than that. So for standard Colombian or Nicaragua standard, it's already above that price. So I wonder what's going to happen. There's going to be some switch. And to go back to my story about Japan, they are seeing a reduction of the quality these people can afford. They are reducing the quality they can pay. So I wonder how it's going to evolve, but it will evolve somehow.
I think it's just interesting when you look at the coffee price and in a coffee shop and how this is also increasing. Even just if you look at Switzerland, it has increased and it's expected to further increase, but not necessarily just or mainly not because of the green coffee price. And I think that's really interesting as a statistic that it's mainly the cost of staff in a restaurant that accounts for almost 50% of the price of the cup of coffee, not the coffee itself. And while the price of coffee beans themselves do have an impact, it's not a major impact on the coffee price. So really what I would like to see in the future is that, yes, these questions are great to ask, like what determines the price of a coffee that I buy in a coffee shop or a supermarket? Asking questions is great. Listening to the answer is even more important. And really kind of look at having this conversation between specialty and commodity sector, part of the sector, is really important, because I do think we need, hopefully we'll keep specialty as well. But yes, it will be, the conversation has to be about not just differentiating specialty based on how much more it pays compared to commodity, because I think this is maybe the wrong basis for that, and more providing what is growing the demand for that differentiated quality and making the consumer understand as well what needs to happen in order to buy great quality coffee, whatever that means for the consumer as well, consistently from a shop or from a supermarket. Everything, every quality is quality. Even the below 80 is quality for someone. And that represents value. So I think I may be more of an advocate for the diversification within the trade. Diversity gives us as a sector strength. We should not just rely on a handful of large companies, both at the roaster or trader side, or even a handful of large specialty roasters who also maybe find it challenging to define themselves and as the niche, because they are growing quite big. Which is great, but really is the diversity, so that we have room, space, and business model and value for everyone. This is what we would like to encourage, and within SETA as well. We are not just for the large, we are also for the smaller traders and roasters who are interested in the supply chain part. So we really want to represent everyone.
The words of Christina resonate deeply. Diversity gives us strength. Reflecting on our discussion over the past hour, more than 95% of the world's coffee is traded through the systems Guillaume described. However, many in the specialty coffee will prefer alternative methods to source, finance, and buy coffee. In practice, though, a trader is often involved at some point in the process. Diverse approaches to sourcing, financing, purchasing, and transporting coffee are essential if we want to see progress in a world that relies on such a fragile system. As we heard, traders operate on razor-thin margins, less than 2%, which means they must rely on high volumes to stay viable. But what happens when coffee supplies decrease and prices surge? This is the reality we're facing today. The times are changing rapidly, and I hope this episode has shed some light on the complexities of the trade, why it functions the way it does, and the challenges it faces. I look forward to hearing you soon again. Take care.